You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Nicole Krause's latest novel, Great House, explores memory, loss, and legacy as it weaves together the lives of several characters linked by a single object, a massive old writing desk. Ms. Krause's last novel, A History of Love, was shortlisted for the Orange Prize, and in 2010, The New Yorker named her one of the 20 best writers under 40. Her new novel is published by Norton, and I'm very pleased that it brings Nicole Krause back to our show. Hello.
Thank you. Hi.
Your last book and now this one have nonlinear structures. So what is it about that approach that appeals to you?
I have to feel setting out in the writing that I don't know what's going to happen. It's absolutely critical to me that I become lost in the work. And so I found that this way of choosing these kind of remote points, these distant characters who are mysteries to me as people, but also that their connections to each other are still unknown, allows for this possibility of discovery.
But you have to shift back and forth between them. So do you write it that way, or do you write a more linear way and then break it up later?
I tend to write my books exactly in the order that you read them, that they sort of remain that way. So
do you start off with the same first sentence?
No. I mean, I edit within the voices, but in terms of, I don't know ever what's going to happen in the story, so I can't jump ahead and jump back. I do once I've written sort of parts of the book and I realize something's going to happen, I have to go back and change something else.
I asked about the first sentence because Michael Cunningham was here recently, and he says if he doesn't get the first sentence, he doesn't get the second sentence.
Well, it's interesting with the first sentence of this book, or rather, in this case, it's turned into the second sentence, but it begins with, "Your Honor." And in fact, the beginning of the book was a short story. I thought it was a short story, and I published it as such. And only later did I realize that it was unfinished. I couldn't stop thinking about it. And one of the first things I did when I returned to it and decided that it might become something larger is I had this instinct to put "Your Honor" in the beginning. So it changed everything. It changed the focus. It introduced this sense of guilt, the sense of it being a confession. And I had no idea who that Your Honor was that the character was speaking to.
The one reviewer said that this is that the whole thing has a very Jewish confessional sense to it, but a Jewish confessional, which is different than other kinds of confessionals.
I don't think that Jews really know what confession. Well, I don't know that there is such a thing as Jewish confession.
Well, these confession. People are always explaining themselves, trying to explain themselves to themselves and to everyone else.
Absolutely. And I became very interested from the beginning in the idea of judges, of judgment, of a deposition. And then finally from that became interested in the notion of confession, of what is that emotional place where we feel we need to confess ourselves to another.
The first section is very, very powerful. And I always wonder about starting off a book with something that's creates so much emotion in the reader, because then there's the fear that the next section is going to be a bit of a letdown.
Mm. I guess I don't worry about it when the work feels emotional to me, when I've gotten to the place in my character that feels most tender, most fragile, most dangerous, really, I know that the work is becoming alive to me.
The device of having something connect a wide range of characters has been around for a while, but it's usually a pound note or a pair of earrings, never something as huge as a large desk.
Well, I guess I would want to say two things about that. One is that I don't often think of the desk as the center of the book, largely because I tried to write a book that had no center. I was interested in the idea of these many moving parts and voices and stories that were working and connecting on these different lateral levels, but without a central place or character or idea or theme. And so the desk is certainly something that does connect the characters, but it is one of many moving parts.
And it's different things to the various characters. It's an heirloom. It's a place to write. It's something of a family tree.
There is a funny story about the desk, though, which is that it appeared in that short story, which was the first thing I wrote that became the novel. And then that short story was included in an anthology, and I was asked to write about a little paragraph about the inspiration for the story. So I went into my study at the top floor of my house and thought to myself, where did this story come from? And I looked up at my desk, naturally, and suddenly it dawned on me, and it sounds absurd, of course, but there are these blinders that we put on ourselves as writers in order to to be free. I realized that the desk in the story was very much like my own desk. And more than that, I had inherited that desk, just like the character in the book, from the former owner of my house, in my case. And I hate the desk. It's an overbearing, enormous, quite masculine, quite ugly desk. But I, as I said, it's on the top floor of my house. And to get rid of it, I would have to chop it up. And that seems sort of sad to me. So I've come to think of the desk as this kind of burden of mine, a responsibility. And I keep writing at it.
Well, for some people, they also become – things like that become talisman. Or some writers have rituals, or they have – I remember reading about one writer, Kawabata, who used to lie on a certain cot, which he considered to be his magical cot. And he had to do that for a little while before he could get up and start writing. Others have to have all their pencils sharpened.
Yeah, I always like to think of myself as a writer who doesn't have rituals, because I'd like to think that I can somehow write anywhere. I don't know if that's the case, and certainly this desk has now insinuated itself into my life.
Well, it really, in the case of Nadja, the first character, she has a writer's block when the desk, she no longer has the desk.
Yes, when this desk, which she's written at for 27 years, which she inherited from this young Chilean poet who disappears, when suddenly this young woman who claims to be the poet's daughter comes to claim it and takes it away from her, it begins a kind of unraveling, a mental unraveling of Nadja that sends her reeling.
The book, The Desk is Rumative, belonged to the poet Federico Garcia Lorca. And Lorca was executed by Franco's fascists at the start of the Civil War. Your poet, Daniel Varsky, is killed after the Pinochet coup in Chile.
Yes, that period in Chilean history became something I absolutely obsessed over before I ever started writing this novel. I read everything about those disappeared people. I saw every movie. It got to the point where I couldn't sleep at night. And I was at the time pregnant with my first son. And in retrospect, I think in some way it was a way to face this enormous vulnerability that was opening up in me of going to have this child in this world whose well-being my entire happiness was going to rest on. But I thought I'd write a whole novel that would sort of take place in that era. But instead, it kind of all became absorbed into this dark blot of this quite ghostly character, Daniel Varsky, who never has his own voice in the book, but who haunts the book, various stories of the book.
My guest is Nicole Krauss. Her latest novel is called Great House, and it is published by Norton. Well, a number of the characters speak in their own voices, but in a couple of cases, we know about them through other people. And those were decisions you had to have made fairly early. Otherwise, you would have had a very different book.
It was never – I know that this sounds sort of almost silly, but it was never a decision, conscious decision. At some point, I did realize that many of my characters were telling the stories of another.
Which is kind of third person, even though it's first person.
Yes, although – except that they delve so deeply, these first-person voices or monologues, confessions, into their own psychologies as well as the psychology of what the other, whom they are compelled or obsessed by.
Your last novel, The History of Love, was very well received. Did that make it harder or easier to write this one?
Well, it came as such a complete and utter shock to me that that book was well received. When I was writing it, I was convinced that nobody would want to read it. And I remember when I gave it to the first person to read it, I pushed it across the table and was actually crying, feeling that no one was going to sort of want this thing. But I was still very committed to writing it. So it still seems to me like this experience outside of time to me that happened with The History of Love. And as such, it's not part of my plan. I mean, I would be so happy. It would mean so much to me if this book, Great House, and any book that I would write finds its readers and finds readers that really connect with it. And I hope there are many. But it's not ultimately the ambition. The ambition is to write the book that I was meant to write, and I feel that so strongly that the experience didn't unsettle me.
Mm. Again, Michael Cunningham said the exact opposite, that he says writers have to think about who's going to read it ultimately.
I think that certainly has to come into the picture, particularly as you're beginning to wrap the book together and to edit it, and you have to think about what the experience of the reader is going to be like. But for me, for a very long time and foremost in my mind is my own sort of aesthetic sense and intuitions.
Several of your characters are writers, and the two women who are writers can be rather unpleasant. In Nadja's case, she has pretty much cut herself off from other people. The other writer, we learned about her through her husband, and she is very difficult to live with. Did you model them after anyone in particular? I hope this is not autobiographical.
No. Well, I see a big distinction between the autobiographical and the personal. And I think these characters and the book is very personal to me in that it is filled with emotions that run very deep for me, or emotions that I maybe explored and were unknown to me. They don't necessarily come from my own experience, but it does feel personal. But no, they're not modeled certainly on me or really anyone that I know.
But they give you an opportunity to talk about what it's like to be a writer.
They do. And I also, I didn't want to choose characters that were necessarily likable right away. For example, there's a father in the book, an Israeli father, whose name is Aaron. And in the beginning, he describes himself as almost a kind of tyrannical father. And he's at the end of his life staring death in the face. And his estranged son has come back to him. And
he's really, made that kid's life miserable.
He has. And in the beginning, I thought, who is this quite terrible person, this clearly terrible father? But that interested me. And I, as I began to write him, as I began to embody him, I realized that, he was somebody who felt all his life that his son had shut him out, that he had been chosen against. His son had chosen the mother over him. And all his life, he desperately wanted to understand his child. He wanted to be let into his child's life, but instead became hardened because of the rejection. And suddenly that turns this person, who is quite a difficult person, into somebody who I hope the reader has quite a great deal of compassion and empathy for.
Didn't you begin your writing career as a poet?
I did.
Yeah. Do you think that affects the way you use language and imagery in your fiction?
I certainly know that, you know, I spoke to an Italian journalist the other day, and she said something wonderful, which I will cling to. And she said, you know, the real protagonist of this book is the language. And I think that that is always of sort of primary importance to me.
Well, one critic said that this novel owes a debt to the recent novels of Roberto Bolaño, a writer who also was very involved with language.
I love Bolaño. I mean, and I feel like my writing is a debt to so many writers who I'm crazy about. And I feel that it's very important to me to allow all of the writers that I love into my work, because this book, as well as History of Love, are ultimately about really the power of literature, which I think is a kind of singular power, holds a singular place in our life, which is, it affords us this opportunity to fully step into another's inner life.
Well, I mentioned earlier that it's also about memory, loss, legacy. Of course, those are also the subjects of literature.
Yes. I mean, in a way, every novel is in some way or other about memory, I suppose. I think I like to think about these characters as a study of the remembering mind, in a way, which is quite a different thing than memory as a subject.
Do you think that you will continue to write novels in this way?
I don't know. For me right now, it is the most exciting way to write them. But then the other day I thought to myself, how could I take a singular voice, a singular narrative, and make it incredibly complex? Now suddenly that became interesting to me. But the complexity, yes, that will always remain, I think.
Well, I didn't want to talk too much about the plot here because there are constant surprises. And
yeah.
You suggested when we began talking that they were surprises to you as well.
They are. Yes, they absolutely were. And I think that is critical. And for me, I have to enter the book feeling that I'm going to discover things about myself that I don't know. And I hope the reader will have the same experience.
We also discover a lot about this desk.
Yes.
Great House. Why Great House?
There's a story that you only discover towards the end of the novel, but it's a wonderful story, which is about a first century rabbi, Ben Zakkai. And it's really a story about what can Judaism become after the loss of Jerusalem, the loss of the temple, after it was conquered by the Romans. And there's this beautiful decision. I've thought about this moment in history many times in my life and always sort of returned to it. And this moment when this Jewish sage, Ben Zakkai, made a kind of decision, well, we've lost the place, this physical place on which Judaism has always depended and which it revolved around. What now can it become? And it's this radical moment of self-reinvention where he says, well, we will, instead of sacrifice the temple, we will depend on prayer. We'll take something which was external and will make it internal and therefore make it portable. It survived in the diaspora because of that. And that moment in which one changes radically because of catastrophic loss with this intense imagination and will, to me, is an incredibly awesome thing.
Nicole Krause's latest novel is called Great House. It is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's a pleasure.